Trailer parks and the people who live in them are a cheap punchline in this country, mostly because they're a refuge for working Americans without a lot of money to spare. But some of these spaces are real communities where folks live for years and know and care about their neighbors. Lately, though, real estate corporations are buying up mobile home communities by the hundreds with an eye on profits, but not on people. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. One huge problem is that many residents of these places own their mobile home unit, but only lease the land it sits on. When their communities are bought out by investors looking to make quick money, some residents find themselves in a double bind, unable to afford new higher land lease rates and unable to scrape together the money to move their homes somewhere less expensive. Sarah Terry is a director, producer, and cinematographer. Her new film for the PBS documentary series America Reframed is called A Decent Home. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Chris, thanks so much, and what a great intro and summation of the basic issues here.
Well, thank you. What made you want to investigate this story?
You know, I was thinking on, I'd made two documentaries, didn't really know, you know, if I had a third one in me, and was actually reading, this was back in 2015, believe it or not, that's how long documentaries can take sometimes, but I read an article in The Guardian about something called Mobile Home University, which you actually see in the film. It's where people are taught how to buy and sell parks and make the most money they can. But there was a little short paragraph in that article that really sent me through the roof, and it was this: the Carlyle Group, which is one of the largest private equity firms in the world, had just started buying up mobile home parks, and the rest of the private equity world was watching. I think the wealth gap is the biggest issue facing like global humanity. I think that greed is the face of climate change, you know, systemic racism, you name it. So to see this, to see some of the richest people in the world going after housing that is, you know, on the lowest rung of what we have called the American dream was just outrageous to me. And 6 weeks later, I was actually at Mobile Home University filming.
And talk a little bit about how people are trained to decide which mobile home parks to buy and what makes them a good value and how to handle them once they've made that purchase.
It's a super ruthless sort of course. It's kind of the face of what predatory capitalism has become, you know, fed by that idea that make the most money you can is the way to go. That means you're a good American. You know, you're a smart human being. It revolves around this man named Frank Rolf, who with his partner Dave Reynolds had become one of the largest park owners in the United States. And hopefully your listeners will get to actually watch the film because they'll see just this amazing scene with him in which he tells people, you don't want to know your customers' names. You don't have a relationship with them. You're just renting them land. He advises people to cut down trees, empty swimming pools, reduce anything that adds to a capital expense. And then also to immediately raise lot rents, because historically mobile home park ownership has been a mom and pop business and rents were reasonable. You know, it was like, we get a fair rent, you get a fair, you know, space for your home. And once the world of private equity, once capitalism in its, you know, classic sense, discovered this vacuum of lower rents and a way that they could be raised. I mean, Frank Rolf said, I heard him, you know, say it in one of these classes. Look, I guarantee you, you raise the rent on that lot by $25 a month. And because it costs thousands to move a home, I guarantee you that person is just going to go down to the local Walmart and get a few more hours of work each week. Yeah, it's that cold. And it's the encapsulation of an American way of doing business that in its current iteration is rooted in Milton Friedman's infamous, you know, quote in the New York Times Magazine, or his article, what he wrote was that the only social responsibility of a corporation is to make more money for its shareholders. So I feel like we are now in like the last stages of that kind of carnivorous thinking, because it's going to destroy itself. It's not a maintainable way of doing business.
And just in case it's not clear to folks, Sarah, the reason that new owners are advised not to get to know the tenants that they provide land to is because then they might feel bad about
because then you
charging
might have
them so
to
much.
Acknowledge that that person is a human being. You might know that they're working three jobs, that their mother is sick, that they're on Social Security, that they're a veteran, that they're any of the things that make us human beings with needs and hard times and hopes. You know, it's just like, nope, it's business. It's just business. And that's what the film is fighting against. You know, it's like saying, no, we're human beings. And when you talk about things like best use of the land, which is a very real estate kind of driven term, best use of the land, what they're talking about is how you make the most money from the land. Whereas I think conversations about best use of the land need to be about affordable housing and thriving communities. And we're hoping that these conversations are starting to help push the balance that way.
So I really learned a lot from this documentary. And one thing that will stick with me is the extent to which, in a lot of ways, mobile home parks have served almost like a loophole in the affordable housing crisis for a really long time, right? People who could not afford to buy like a permanent freestanding home in their city might sometimes be able to afford a mobile home.
Oh my goodness. It's the largest source of unsubsidized affordable housing in America, which means no taxes, you know, no taxpayers' money, no nothing goes in to support this type of housing. These are people, there's a wonderful woman in the film called Luz Galicia, who was able to buy her mobile home for $10,000. She was divorced. She had come on harder times economically. She had two daughters she wanted to be able to send to college, and that answered her needs. And it's there's a park in the film that's right next door to Google headquarters in Silicon Valley. You know, like if you think you know what a mobile home park looks like, go see that park, because Google employees live there because they can't afford to buy a home in Silicon Valley. So that's another thing we're addressing in the film, is breaking that stereotype, calling out in many ways that sort of last pejorative that we're allowed to use in polite conversation, which is trailer trash. And we're saying, no, you don't get to use that anymore. You don't get to talk that way about this kind of housing or these kinds of people, because it's an incredibly important housing stock for America. 20 million people live in mobile homes.
What did you learn about the communities that form in some of these places?
I think these places have so much to teach the rest of us about what community is. You know, about things like how much enough is. There are some very tight connections in the communities that I worked in. And I'm not, you know, perpetuating a stereotype of, oh, it's all everybody gets along or all every mobile home park is wonderful. Every neighborhood, you know, anywhere has problems, whatever type of housing it is. But the parks that I worked in, there was an incredible caring of neighbors for neighbors. Candy Evans, who lives in a park in Iowa, regularly is out there. She's retired. She's okay. You know, I mean, she's been stretched by the lot rents, but she's able to stay. She had a retirement income, but she looks out for her neighbors. She cooks food when people need it. If somebody's sick, she's there. You know, it's a much more shared sense of community and caring than I find in a lot of, you know, for example, suburban, you know, American places. There's a great sense of, I know you, you know, you, and we might not agree politically, or, you know, we might not agree on a lot of things, but we share this space and we're neighbors, and your well-being is part of my well-being.
So you mentioned already that historically these mobile home parks were like family businesses, you know, mom and pop operations that might be passed down from one generation to the next. Who were the early customers for mobile home parks?
There could be another film on the history of mobile homes. the very first people who had mobile homes were the wealthy. They were the people who could afford to buy cars. And it's a little bit of a reset of your mind to stop and go, oh, wait, before, you know, we didn't always have motels and highways. Mm. You know, it's just like they got these cars and they went on their, you know, road trips as far as they could go, and they had no place to stay. So quite often they would trick out cars or have them custom done to become little traveling houses, you know, or there's a 1910 Landau that was actually built this way that folds out to sleep in the back and has a toilet in it. So they began in that space of extreme wealth. And they also fed into this traditionally, you know, American sense of mobility and exploration. They sort of thrived, you know, with that type of that part of our temperament. But by the Depression, they wound up becoming places that people had to sleep in as people lost their homes. And that kind of began the first very negative connotation around mobile homes. And by the way, the common term these days is manufactured housing. I say mobile homes because most Americans don't have an idea of what manufactured housing is or even what's involved with mobile homes not being mobile anymore. But then there's a long trail, you know, up and down of mobile homes being cool and mobile homes being the place where, you know, a phrase I hate, where trailer trash lived. And historically, our media stereotypes have reinforced the idea of dead end, failure, and, you know, trailer. For the most part.
Hang on a second, Sarah. We're getting some dropouts here. So you said, if you can pick up again, you said historically,
yep,
there were, you know, these talks about trailer trash. Can you kind of start there?
Tell me where I was historically, because I got recordings on my end telling me it's being transcribed and recorded that came from the app itself, I guess. So tell me, had I made it through the Depression? Tell me where to go.
Yes, you made it through the Depression, and you, I think you were talking about historically, mobile homes have been cool
and
then
down.
Not cool, right?
Yeah, I got it. Okay, so picking up here. So historically, there's been a big cycle or continuous cycles of mobile homes are cool. You know, they're things that people sort of went off and adventured in and traveled America and stayed in a park for a while and then moved on to another park. But then there were these continual pushbacks in these periods of time where they were seen in very negative terms. And that's where the usage of terms like trailer trash came in. And media representations have only helped make that worse. Almost any time you see a mobile home park or somebody who lives in a mobile home park in a Hollywood movie, for example, it's a dead end representation. You know, Hilary Swank and Boys Don't Cry. It's a place of despair. And it is not, you know, a reflection of reality. You know, there are just so many ways in our culture where we have othered these people and this form of housing. And again, with a decent home, you know, those were among my primary goals, to go look here, come visit here, come see these people, come care about them, come care about their homes, and now take a big deep think and look at what's happening. Because the other end of that private equity and those big money investors taking over mobile home parks is they're starting to do the same thing across every sector of affordable housing in the United States. They're buying up single family homes everywhere and turning them into rental properties. We are being priced out of affordable housing at virtually every level, apart from the ultra wealthy in the United States. It started the canaries in the coal mine, you know, where the mobile home residents.
Sarah, early indications of the way this industry was starting to change came in the western part of the country, where you explain there's often kind of a libertarian attitude toward the rights of landowners. The idea, right, that if you own this land, you can do whatever you want. What is the practical effect of that for people who live in mobile home parks?
Well, In particular, I focused in the film, one of the main stories in the film is in Colorado, where that libertarian philosophy is deeply ingrained. And historically, it means a reluctance of government at the state or and local levels to impose any kind of regulations or restrictions on landowners. Like you said, it's kind of like, yeah, it's your land, do whatever you want. And what that has meant, for example, in the film, without giving anything away, you'll learn that a park owner has decided he wants to take advantage of rezoning of a park that used to be out in the sticks and is now right next to a $5 billion medical campus in Aurora, Colorado. He wants to rezone and sell it for a lot more money. And the city, I mean, that's an understatement, for millions of dollars. And the city is loath to tell him he can't do that. They're pretty, interested in letting the zoning ordinances change in his favor. And until the residents rise up, and their 3-year battle is part of the story of the film, including the city, the local activists who ran for city council, because they were so outraged by the actions of a city council in this case that was primarily made up of developers and people with investments in real estate. So you can start to see, I think, through that election, the importance of understanding who's on your city council has a lot to do with what your city looks like and who has housing and who doesn't.
And that's the case for people who live within city limits. A lot of times these places are located outside city limits and there may not be much protection even available to them, right?
That's where state laws come in. It's interesting, Colorado went from being one of the worst states in the country to being sort of in the top 5 or 6 state sections for mobile home park residents now. That's because of the activism of the mainly Spanish-speaking community residents in my film, in Denver Meadows Mobile Home Park. And so it's an important, some parks can just fall between the cracks where we're trying to figure out who should be protecting them or what laws could protect them. So it takes there's a weaving of state, local, county regulations that affect this, and it's through zoning and development laws and things sometimes that seem a little bit complicated to follow. Federal laws work at a different level in terms of bringing pressures to bear on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who until recently, although they still do, but they had been giving loans to private equity firms to buy mobile home parks as part of their affordable housing program, which is just like another smack your forehead moment of like going, I'm sorry, what did you just say? Private equity firms who are jacking up lot rents, but because they were buying mobile home parks, those were considered affordable housing. So yeah, it's like we haven't, how would I say this? We haven't fully integrated this type of housing. And I mean, it's a class issue in a lot of ways, in almost every way that surrounds particularly mobile home parks and how we try to ignore them. And I think the current economic realities we're facing and the affordable housing crisis, which is that, that place you thought you were going to move because if the housing was going to be affordable is already too expensive. We're just coming into this sort of huge crash of like, oh my gosh, is a home something that people need to thrive as human beings? And the communities need thriving human beings to be thriving communities? Or is a home just a commodity to be bought and sold, to the highest bidder? Because we're on track for the latter. That's what's happening right now. And again, to everybody, I mean, I believe it was something like 1 in 5 home sales last year, maybe 2 in 5, were to corporations, not to, couples, families, single people. It was to corporations. That's where our housing stock is going.
How much are rents going up in these parks that get bought out?
Well, Candy Evans, the woman I mentioned who's in Iowa, she just had a notice tacked to her door. Oh gosh, that was back in 2019, I think. That said, her lot rent was going up by 63%.
Wow.
And yeah, 63%. Now you stop and kind of go, well, okay, so she was paying a lot rent of about $280. Maybe to somebody who lives in a large city or people who pay the kind of rents that, you know, we pay, you know, you pay on the coast or whatever, because sort of go, well, geez, $200 isn't bad. You know, I wish I had an increase of 200 as opposed to, you know, something higher. But 63% is the increase. Think of your mortgage going up 63% and not being able to protect yourself in any way, because there's nothing, there's no law that says it can't be done to you.
So then the problem is, you know, people might be listening and thinking, well, then you just pick up and move. Picking up and moving is hard enough when you just have to get your stuff across town. Having to move your entire home. Explain why this is not as easy as it sounds.
For at least, gosh, almost 50 years, mobile homes have been, they're manufactured in a factory and they're brought on site. You often see them, you know, on freeways that split in two,
right,
going down a freeway on a very long trek. It's being brought to a site and placed there essentially permanently, because to pick it up and move it, which you could do, can be, you know, $10,000, $20,000, depending on the home, you know, and its size. And then there's two additional factors there, which is that homes that were built before 1976 don't withstand that kind of moving. The building standards were different then. Many mobile home parks won't accept mobile homes that were built before that time. Sometimes they're even like, oh no, your house has to be, can't be older than 5 years old. Again, because they can do that. And then you also throw into that you can't always find a place to move your home, because this form of affordable housing is so much in demand that there aren't always vacancies at mobile home parks. And oh, by the way, I don't know when the last time a new mobile home park was built in the United States.
So what happens to people who cannot afford to move the housing unit that they may own outright?
They walk away. Frank Rolfe is kind of pretty gleeful about that at one point, where he goes, look, they can't afford it. You know, they leave the house behind. It's a win-win for you, you know, because you get to keep that house, repurpose it, and bring in another person. Because you then own the house as the park owner, and you can rent it out. That's happened. You know, there were in the film, there are people, I won't give away stories, but there are people who lose everything because they couldn't afford the lot increases, the rent increases on their lot rents. Yeah, it happens. And it doesn't very often make the news. Other people, I mean, there are still people at one of the parks in the film where one of the main characters, like they don't know where they are. They don't know what's happened to them or where they've gone. Some people move in with their families. Some people move to other states. It's, if you don't have the money, you lose everything. You lose your quote unquote American dream. You lose your capital. You know, it's another example of ways that capital isn't passing down through generations. It's at the core of our economic well-being in this country.
You know, to hear you describe that, Sarah, it sounds no different than what happens to communities that experience a natural disaster, right? A tornado or a hurricane, where people have to just scatter in the aftermath. This is not a natural disaster. This is a man-made disaster.
That's a wonderful way to describe it and to make that comparison. Yeah, it's a man-made disaster. We're letting it happen, you know, by our inaction, by the fact that we are loath to pass laws that tell landowners, you know, they've got to live up to certain things with that land that they own. You know, there's ways. It's funny because I work with a group out of Montana. They're housing activists like all over the country who have embraced the film, shared the film, showed it. It's really encouraging to know that the film is helping meet a need. But they've identified you know, languaging problems. Like if you say the word rent control, you're going to immediately go into some kind of a partisan analysis of what that means, and you'll have a reaction to it one way or the other. But if you talk about homes that can be afforded by the people who live in your community at the wages they're making, you start a different conversation. You know, maybe you use a few more words, but if you can get past all those labels and past all the things that we think we know or the things that we have an automatic reaction to, and start to go, well, wait a minute, what happens? I mean, it's part of what I've been saying, you know, through this interview. What do you want with home? Nobody's asking you for a handout here. Nobody's asking you to spend any money on them. They're just asking for some protection. They're asking that we have a conversation about how much is enough. Like, how much money, you know, back to Milton Friedman, you know, the only responsibility of a corporation is to make more money for its shareholders. Well, how much money? And at what cost? And at what destruction to our communities? Like, somebody's got to be stepping back and going, hang on, let's go a little deeper here. And that's what the activists that I know working in this area around the country are trying to do. You know, they're building across Republican and Democrat divides. Park activists who are very involved in the movement to try to preserve parks and to help residents buy the parks they live in, they come from, they're Republicans and Democrats. They're working across like that political divide. It's truly a space of common dialogue. I think that whole, you know, something Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy Jr. talked about, which was to begin to have conversations around economics and class, because that affects everybody, you know, well, 99% of us at least. You know, those are the ways to build the conversations, to understand what we have in common if we don't protect homes and people who live in them and protect healthy communities.
So, Sarah, if people can no longer afford the rents that have increased in these mobile home parks bought out by investors, and they have to leave behind the home that they paid for, do the new owners of the land have any financial obligation to compensate them for the cost of that house?
No, that would be unusual. Hmm. I'm just trying to, no. Mm-mm. No, here's what's considered progress in protecting mobile home park residents. It's putting a restriction on how many times a year the park owner can raise rent, so that instead of raising it whenever they want to, which is the norm, they can only raise it once a year, twice a year. It's people are still, I don't know of any places, well, there's a few that where there's also a limit on the amount that you can increase it. But in general, an apartment renter has more protection under the law than somebody who owns their home and rents the land they live on in a mobile home park. You have protections. There's no cause evictions. Is quite, you know, is a norm among mobile home parks, which means you can be told for no reason at all that you have, I don't know, 30 days to leave, or sometimes shorter, sometimes a little bit longer, and with no cause. And just imagine what that means to somebody who maybe already is working two or three jobs, that they have to figure out how to raise like at least $10,000 to move their home. They have to figure out where to take their home because they might not find that space to get it. And the level of it's an impossible feat. It can't be done. So people walk away from their homes. And as we were discussing, what happens then is the park owner is like, oh, great. You know, I just got for free a mobile home. And I'm going to maybe clean it up a little bit, fix something or whatever. And then I'm going to rent it. So I have even more control. And I'm making even more money from this park.
When people lease a space in a mobile home park, what does that money pay for besides the right to put your home on a certain amount of square footage?
Pretty much nothing these days. It used to be that it paid for some of your utilities, and it still does in some areas. And some park owners used to include cable in it. There were perks, but again, as Wall Street, private equity, big money investors have come in, they're just stripping all those things away, you know, a la Frank Rolfe. Don't spend money that you don't need to spend. So you're basically just paying for the land. And the industry tries to make a big argument that, oh, it's so expensive to operate a mobile home park. We're responsible for the upkeep of the roads. We're responsible for the sewer lines, which, you know, they are. But if something happens to a home, unlike if you were an apartment building owner, you're responsible for fixing the broken pipes, the roof, you know, anything that goes wrong in an apartment, you fix it. But a mobile home park owner doesn't fix anything for anybody's houses. The homeowners have to fix it. So there's pretty much almost no expense or very minimal expenses in owning a park. And so much so that one of the private equity firms that's featured in the film, Haven Park Capital, their website is now closed, but I was able to find it and the pages on it that talked to their investors saying, we're earning money from day one. You know, the cash flow is incredible in this area. And they're pumping up all these reasons that it's good money. It's easy money. It's secure money. And then publicly, they'll try to say, oh, yeah, but we have to repair that road.
Sarah, another argument that I know you came up against was people claiming that if these parks do not jack up rents much closer to something like the cost of market value housing nearby, the parks will just be eliminated entirely. Is that true?
That just continues on the double speak that we were just talking about, because it that came up in an interview. It's actually in the film with Frank Rolfe, who runs Mobile Home University, who owns 160, I think, mobile home parks in the United States, or he did at the time. It's this, you know, you're listening to it and it's like, oh, wow, it's important to have the park. And okay, well, maybe you do need to raise the rent a little bit because there's pressures on the land and somebody else could turn it into, you know, a strip mall. But then you stop and go, it's like, and I said it differently, but wait a minute, you own the land. What are the pressures? Like, what are you talking about? There's no pressure on you if you're happy with the amount of money you're making. You can just say, yeah, sure, I can make, you know, $20 million more if I turn it into a strip mall. But nobody's got a gun to your head and telling you you have to do that. And in this film, you know, you see Frank look at me and goes, yeah. He goes, yeah, that's absolutely right. So it's just like you have to stop and go. I mean, I honestly, that idea of pressure on the land, highest use, best use of the land, those are things I'd certainly, I mean, I'm not a real estate, I've always been a general assignment journalist and storyteller. I'm interested in a lot of things. So as I came into this world and heard these terms, you sort of go, yeah, best use of the land. And you think that seems like a reasonable argument. But then you stop and you understand that when a commercial developer is talking about best use of the land, they are talking about how to make the most money. And it's time for us to have a different conversation about what best use of the land means in this country. You know, it's time for us to rein in this sort of Milton Friedman, greed is good thinking that's dominated our culture, our business relations, our thoughts for these 50 years. It's time for us to rein that in and go, yeah, you know what? Greed isn't good. We need to talk about what's reasonable. And I don't mean like the government needs to say, oh, you can't make more than this. I'm not talking about socialism or any of those things. I'm talking about a reasonable conversation in our society that just says, really? You know, at what cost do we just say, yeah, sure, go become a trillionaire. And oh gosh, look at the millions of Americans who can't afford a place to live. Like, do you want to live in that America? I mean, that's why I slammed my feet down on the floor the day I read that article in The Guardian that said that the Carlyle Group was starting to buy mobile home parks. I could not stand the thought of living in an America that looks like that. That's not my America. I don't think it's the America, you know, that most of the people I know believe in. You know, whether you're Republican, Democrat, way conservative, way liberal, or whatever else. I don't want to live in that place. And, you know, that passion is, that commitment and conviction is what's behind the film.
We should make sure listeners understand the folks who are going through this are not just sort of sitting back and letting it happen to them. Talk about what you learned about communities trying to push back against these changes, keep their homes affordable.
Well, they are, you know, these are some of the most amazing people I've ever met in my life. Just average people, you know, Luz Galicia, who had a cleaning business, was cleaning businesses, and trying to put her two daughters through college in the park in Colorado that's in the film. Candy Evans, 71 years old, retired grandmother, who had sold her roofing business that she and her husband had had for so many years. She's a widow now, and she was, you know, going to enjoy time with her grandkids. And for both of those women and for so many other people, when they were confronted with these threats to their livelihood and to their communities, you know, I don't mean their livelihoods, I mean their homes and their communities, they just were like, okay, no, this doesn't work. They had they built relationships with other local activists in Colorado. 9 to 5 has been very active in this world. In Iowa, the Teamsters, you know, have gotten involved because the Teamsters understand it's, you know, if you could fight for good wages, but if your workers can't afford a place to live, what's the point? So they have bonded. They've learned how to go to their, I mean, these residents of Denver Meadows in Aurora, Colorado, working 2 and 3, went every Monday night to the city council meetings in Aurora, in different groups of members and people when they could, for 3 years to protest to their park. And it's funny because I sometimes have met people at film festival screenings who come up afterwards and go, well, what can I do? And I'm like, well, first and foremost, start going to your city council meetings, pay attention when housing is on the agenda and development. And they're like, oh, well, that's a lot, or I can't always get there. And I said, did you just watch that film? Did you see those low-income Hispanic-speaking people in Aurora, Colorado, who went every Monday night? You know, they went. I think if they can go, we can go. You know, it's just a mindset around that. And I learned from these people who just made these priorities, not just I want to save my home, but I want to save my neighbor's home. I want to save my community. And the sense of, you know, there's another resident of Denver Meadows in the film, a woman called Petra Bennett, who talks about how much is enough, you know, and she actually says at one point, when are the rich rich enough? Like, that's kind of a sobering question, isn't it? Like, how much do you need? How many houses? How many cars? And that's the amazing thing about everybody I met who lives in a mobile home park. They know how much enough is. They may not always have it. They may not always have the money they need to pay their bills, but they know how much enough is. A home for their family, food on the table, you know, education, a healthy community. And it's such a sobering reassessment to me of how much is enough. And one, it's why I hold them up so dearly in the film. It's why I try to have somebody, you know, from the film or from a park present at the festival screenings, because I want to say, these people, you know, these should be our heroes. We should be following behind them because they can tell us how much enough is. You know, we've lived in a hyper-consumerist society for so long. I mean, I remember the 1980s, you know, those t-shirts that said, whoever has the most stuff when he dies wins. You know, there was this culture of get stuff, own stuff, buy stuff. And that's changed a bit now. I think younger generations are more interested in experiences, but there's still, you know, an acquisitive thread that's almost mesmeric in its pull on us as Americans. And to somehow think, you know, that protecting somebody means that the rest of us lose is beyond me.
So what's involved for residents of a mobile home park community to band together and try to purchase the land they live on to either push out these rapacious developers or just prevent them from showing up in the first place?
There are organizations working nationally. There's some very interesting alternatives and opportunities. There's a group called Rock USA, which is Resident-Owned Communities USA. They started in New Hampshire in the 1980s, and they have helped residents across the country buy the parks they live in. There's over 300 of those parks now. And in that process, and you see it in the film, it's a process that works in one park and failed in another park, and you'll understand the reasons why. But it's why it's important that states have what's called an opportunity to purchase law, because that gives park residents the right to make a competitive offer, not a reduced offer, but the same, you know, fair market offer for the park they live in. It gives them time to get the financing in place. And that's where Rock USA comes in to help organize the residents as a co-op to provide the financing, to provide the training in financing. Park residents are required to hire, you know, a financial manager for the park. That's what a lot of people are organizing to do. It's not the only answer to save your park. Some residents have put their parks, been able to put their parks in land trusts. To raise the amount of money that's needed, you need grants, or you need support from like Rock USA. There's a park in Durango, Colorado, not in the film, but the residents, with the help of Rock USA, put together 6 different mortgages to be able to buy the park they live in out from under a private equity investor in the park. So it's a little of a David versus Goliath battle, because federal financing laws, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, have been tipped towards private equity investors. Until recently, that's changing. But just sometimes it takes longer to put these deals together, and private equity is that, you know, when you get that, I would like to make a cash offer on your property, that's Wall Street or private equity or, you know, corporation offering to buy your house. So they can move quickly, and it just takes park residents longer to get it all together. But that's also some of the organizing you see in the film is around that. Like, we want to be able to buy our park, and we're going to work towards that. So there's all kinds of ways that residents are fighting with everything they've got to protect their homes and their communities.
This doesn't come up in the film, Sarah, but I would imagine that companies that produce manufactured housing would also be pushing back on these real estate companies coming in to buy up land. I mean, suddenly the affordable proposition they're offering their customers is not so affordable at all anymore.
I am actually not aware of the manufacturers getting involved in the fight, because you would think that. But certainly, like, Warren Buffett owns the largest mobile home manufacturer in the United States, which is Clayton Homes, and 2 of the largest lenders. And he's been accused in the past of lending practices that were discriminatory, racially discriminatory. But I have not heard of a single manufacturer stepping up. I know they have conversations. I know they are, there's friendly relations between them and some of the nonprofits that are working in this sphere, but I honestly can't speak to that with any greater intelligence than that.
Are there any lawmakers talking about actually creating publicly owned parks for mobile homes?
There's a really interesting initiative coming out of Aurora, Colorado. One of the people in the film who got elected to the city council, in a real nail biter of a race. But Juan Marcano, who is now running for mayor of Aurora, is proposing he's called it the first social housing policy in the United States. And it involves the city taking city-owned land and paying for the financing of housing and the building of it, and then selling those homes at cost to genuinely verifiably like low income families. So it puts the city in a position of not making a profit on that, but of creating housing stock on, I mean, Aurora, for example, is only half built out as a city. They have a lot of land. So that's an example of it. Some cities, Boulder, Colorado, has created long-term leases. There's a park in Boulder, I think maybe a couple parks, where the city owns the land, but they put 99-year long-term leases on it at low lot rentals, you know, with limited rental increases on it. So it's happening piecemeal. The way housing and land policy works in the United States, of course, is that it's not a federal issue. It happens at mostly at a local level, and sometimes there's state regulation of it, depending on what the issue is. So it shows up in places like that. It's a very, there was a social housing movement in Germany in, I think it was the early 1940s, that influences a lot of the social housing thinking in the United States today, which is sort of a small group of people. But it's around principles like that of local governments providing housing, you know, at fair rates.
Sarah Terry is a director, producer, and cinematographer. Her new film for the PBS documentary series America Reframed is called A Decent Home. Sarah, thanks for telling this story.
Thank you so much, Chris, for asking such good questions and devoting this much time to it.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can subscribe to our podcast free where you get your podcasts, or listen anytime at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.